Dr. William Luther Pierce, the year 2000. What we can do.
Hello. One of the more common responses I receive from listeners goes something like this. Okay, you've convinced us that we have some very serious problems, but you never tell us what we should do about these problems. 2 weeks ago, I spoke in general terms about the sort of white world we want to have in the future, and again, I received many letters along the line, "I agree with your vision of the future, but you didn't tell us how to get from here to there." But of course, I have often talked with you about what we must do. Sometimes, I should admit, what I tell you is very general. 2 weeks ago, for example, I told you that the new white world we want can only rise out of hard and bloody struggle. That's not very specific. But in other broadcasts, I have been specific. I have talked specifically about some of the things that we must do to get from here to there. I think that the people who complain that I never give solutions to the problems I present are looking at the world a little differently than I am. When they say, "Tell us how to get from here to there," what they really want me to tell them is a safe, easy, and painless way to get from here to there, a quick and sure way. And of course, I cannot tell them that because there is no such way. We have gotten ourselves into a really bad mess, and it inevitably will cost us an enormous amount of blood and suffering to recover from it, if we are able to recover at all. I don't talk much about the specifics of the blood and suffering because, for one thing, that will come a bit later, and we don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves. For another thing, in these soft and comfortable times, most people just can't cope with really hard concepts. I had a letter a couple of days ago from a listener who said that he agreed with most of my broadcast, but that I was too extreme in talking about remedies. He thought that my suggestion that welfare mothers should be sterilized was horrible. Over the top was the expression he used, and that it certainly would turn off people who otherwise would be receptive to my vision of the future. Well, all I can say to that is that if he finds the thought of sterilizing welfare mothers to be over the top, he'll have a hard time coping with the terrible reality which lies ahead of us. He's like one of those gentle and civilized folks who appreciates the bacon he eats with his breakfast, but can't bear to think about the bloody details of how the bacon got from the pig happily rooting in the farmyard to his plate. Sterilizing welfare mothers will be one of the kinder and gentler things we will be obliged to do. Anyway, there's not much point in debating such remedies now, because we're not yet in a position to implement them, and we don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves. We need merely to understand that our struggle will be long and difficult and will involve many things so far over the top that they would cause our more comfortable and civilized listeners to swoon if we got into the details now. The specific remedies that we want to talk about in detail are the things that we actually can do or begin doing now. And the thing that I have spoken about over and over again is communication. Nothing else that we try to do has any chance of getting us from here to there unless we first have acquired the ability to communicate effectively with our people. He who controls the means of communication with the public controls the future. And as I have said at least 50 times in these broadcasts, that is why the Jews, as soon as they began arriving in the United States in the 1890s, began establishing themselves in our mass media. They didn't buy up farmland. They didn't try to get a monopoly in the railroad or steamship business. They didn't try to build a strong position for themselves in the munitions industry or in kitchen appliances. Instead, they began buying up our big city newspapers. By the beginning of the last century, they owned the New York Times. They acquired the Washington Post at a bankruptcy sale during the Great Depression. As soon as the motion picture business began showing its products in theaters, the Jews swarmed into Hollywood and elbowed out all of the Gentiles except Walt Disney. They had to wait until he died to take over the Walt Disney Company. In the 1920s, they began taking over the radio broadcasting industry. When commercial television came on the scene at the end of the Second World War, they controlled it from the beginning. None of this was an accident. From the beginning, they knew what they were doing. They understood that in order to control and corrupt and exploit our society, they must first control the channels of communication. It was as instinctive as a tick finding its way from the tall grass onto a passing dog and burrowing in. It is why they are working so strenuously now to censor the Internet and to persuade the government to enact legislation against speech crime. In America, they still are playing a double game, with some Jews pretending to be supporters of the First Amendment, while other Jews are busy persuading the lemmings that the First Amendment ought to be abolished. But in every country where speech crime legislation has been enacted since the Second World War, the Jews are solidly in favor of that legislation and are the most active agitators for the prosecution of speech criminals, the suppression of banned books, the rigid censorship of the Internet, and every other means to keep dissidents from challenging the Jews' control of the flow of information to the public. So again, our very specific plan for getting from here to the kind of white world we want is to break the grip of our people's enemies on the flow of information and ideas, and to develop our own media for communicating with the people. That may sound prosaic. It may sound dull because it doesn't involve marching in the streets or shooting, but it is absolutely necessary. By itself, of course, it is not enough, but it is the first step. We must be able to inform our people. We must be able to motivate our people. We must be able eventually to move our people. But first, we must be able to communicate effectively with them. Without effective and continuing communication, nothing else is possible. And difficult as it is to fight the lies of the Jews when they already have such a grip on the minds of the lemmings through their media control, it is possible for us also to communicate. By directing our efforts toward the 2 or 3% of our people who still are able to think for themselves rather than toward the lemmings, we are beginning to make a small difference. Through these radio broadcasts and our books and the music we distribute to young people, we are informing people and influencing their thinking, and the Jews hate it. Let me give you a very specific example of why it is so important to be able to communicate with the people. It's also an example of the enormous power of the communications media to influence the perceptions and therefore the attitudes and opinions and behavior of the public for good or for evil. Just 2 weeks ago, I heard a very brief snippet of news on the CNN headline news program that I watch for at least 10 minutes every day. The news announcer mentioned that the second quadruple murder in just 8 days had taken place in Wichita, Kansas, and that the police had 2 suspects in custody. And that was it. No details and no pictures. I thought that certainly there would be details and pictures on later news reports. But in the following days, there was no further mention of the quadruple murders in Wichita. And as I said, I watch the CNN headline news by satellite every day. And in fact, often twice a day, once in the morning and once in the evening. Now, cynic that I am, that sort of behavior by the Jewish news media always makes me suspicious. Especially the fact that there were no pictures, no faces of victims or murderers on the most widely watched television news program in the country. Two quadruple murders in a week in a Midwestern town the size of Wichita, and CNN has nothing to say about it? That's equivalent to two massacres of 40 people each in Chicago in a week. You know what I thought? I was immediately suspicious that there must be something politically incorrect about those murders, some racial angle, perhaps, that the Jewish media bosses had decided we didn't need to be told about. So I asked some of my people to see what they could find out from Wichita area news sources. And within a couple of days, I had a stack of news reports on my desk from the local newspaper, the Wichita Eagle. And I also had photographs of the victims and of the murderers. And then I understood why the Jewish media bosses in New York had decided to keep Americans outside the area right around Wichita from knowing about the murders. Why they had decided to keep telling us over and over and over again about the latest dispute over dimpled ballots in Florida, rather than telling us about the terrible things that happened on a cold night in Wichita just a few days ago. Not just terrible, but also terribly important. So I'll tell you what happened. On the evening of December 14th, five young people, three men and two women, were together in a Wichita house. One of the young women, Suzanne Muller, was a Wichita State University student. Two of the people in the house were high school teachers. They were 26-year-old Jason Beffert and his 25-year-old fiance. The other two young men, Bradley Heike and Aaron Sander, were friends of Beffert and shared the house with him. Sander, 29 years old, was preparing to become a priest. He and Suzanne Muller were dating. All five of the young people in the house that evening were clean-cut, clean-living, all-American types. At about 11 p.m., two black males suddenly showed up at the door with a pistol and forced their way into the house. They led all five of the whites out of the house and drove them away in two vehicles. One of the vehicles was Jason Beffert's new pickup. The blacks drove them around for several hours, stopping at several automatic teller machines where they forced the whites to withdraw money. At about 2 a.m. Friday, the blacks drove to a snow-covered soccer field outside Wichita. There the blacks made the white women undress, and then both blacks took turns raping the two white women. When they had finished, they made all five whites kneel in the snow in a line, then went down the line and shot each of them in the back of the head. After that, the two blacks drove back to the house where Beffert, Heike, and Sander had lived, and ransacked it, stealing television sets, a VCR, and other personal belongings of the victims. Before they left, they killed Beffert's pet dog. One of their victims was not dead, however. Beffert's 25-year-old fiancé regained consciousness shortly after the blacks drove away from the soccer field. Despite having been shot in the back of the head, she ran naked through the snow in the sub-freezing night for a mile until she found a house where a white couple lived who let her in when she pounded on the door and cried for help. She was able to describe the black rapists and killers and their vehicle to the police, and both were arrested a few hours later. The two are brothers, and both have long criminal records. They are typical low-life blacks, one with dreadlocks and the other with his hair in cornrows. One was released from jail just a few days before the killings. That's the story that the media bosses decided didn't merit national coverage. And it wasn't just CNN that killed the story. I spoke to several people who watched the news regularly on other networks, and no one had heard about the Wichita murders. I'm not surprised. That's just the way it is with black-on-white crime, no matter how atrocious. The media bosses simply don't want any information going out to the white public, which might cause any of us to question the wisdom or the rightness of the continued multiculturalizing of America, or which might cause any of us to realize that we're under attack and need to think about protecting ourselves. Well, there's at least one other aspect of this tragedy in Wichita that deserves our attention. All of the victims were able-bodied white people, 3 young men and 2 young women. None was a cripple. One of the young men, Jason Beckert, the high school teacher, also was a basketball coach. And yet, none of them put up any resistance. They let 2 blacks lead all 5 of them out of their house and drive away with them. The 3 white men stood and watched while the 2 blacks took turns raping their women. They all knelt obediently in the snow and let themselves be shot in the back of the head 1 at a time. Why? It's true that they all were Christians. It's true that the priest who conducted the funeral mass for Jason Beckert made a point of telling everyone at the funeral that they should not seek vengeance, but instead should forgive the killers. But you know, Christians didn't used to be such pansies. And it is a shameful fact that many of our young men today who are not especially religious also are not very manly. It's not just the Christians who have let themselves be persuaded that not only is it wrong to defend yourself, but that it's especially wicked to defend yourself against a non-white. To refuse to give a black anything he demands is tantamount to racism. Really, there's a substantial portion of the white population in America who really would have mixed feelings about defending themselves against a black intruder in their homes. They would stand by and watch a black rape a wife, a daughter, or a sister before they would shoot the black. That sort of moral depravity is not all the result of Christian preaching. Most of it comes from the Jewish media, from Hollywood films and television entertainment programs, which condition susceptible elements of the public not to be hostile to blacks, not to resist blacks, not to defend themselves against blacks. In Wichita, where the media bosses couldn't conceal the rapes and murders which took place there 2 weeks ago, whites flooded into Wichita gun stores to purchase firearms for home protection. The Jewish media bosses don't want white people in other parts of the country doing the same thing. They don't want whites deciding to protect themselves. They don't want their media conditioning undone by reality. That's why they suppress news which doesn't serve their purpose. And that's why it's essential for us to be able to stymie their efforts at suppression of the news. We can't do much for the lemmings at this time, of course. The only information they receive comes from network television. They never look for information elsewhere. They don't want to know anything else. But there are 3 or 4 or 5 million white people in America who still are able to think for themselves and who do want to understand what's happening. We're reaching a growing number of these perceptive people every week. After we have reached and informed and motivated enough of them, we'll be able to begin reaching the lemmings. But we must do things a step at a time. We must build our ability to communicate with our people. I'll give you another example of the way we already are able to communicate effectively with those of our people able to think for themselves, in addition to exposing the suppression of news about black-on-white crime. One of the Jews' most important and powerful assets is their Holocaust story. Not only do they use it to extort tens of billions of dollars in so-called reparations from the Gentile world for wrongs they claim were done to them 60 years ago, but they use it to shield themselves from criticism or scrutiny. If I criticize their control of our news and entertainment media, for example, then I am just like one of those awful Nazis who shoved 6 million innocent Jews into gas ovens during the Second World War. That's why most people are afraid of being accused of being anti-Jewish. They are afraid of the Holocaust story. The Jews understand this, of course, and so they protect their Holocaust story jealously. That's why the Holocaust is not subject to examination. If, for example, some scholar, some historical researcher, comes along and says, I wonder whether it was exactly 6 million Jews who were shoved into gas ovens. Perhaps it was only 5 million. Perhaps not every Jew who died perished in a gas oven. Perhaps some of them died in other ways. I think I'll investigate the matter and find out exactly what the details were. Anyone who says that is attacked as a Holocaust denier. They never accuse him of being a Holocaust examiner or a Holocaust scholar. They always call him a Holocaust denier. They portray him as some sort of nutcase, flat earth theorist who believes that no Jews died during the war, that there were no concentration camps, that there was no persecution of Jews, that there was no Holocaust. That's what's implied by the label Holocaust denier. And it's a fraudulent label, a crooked label. Virtually no one believes that no Jews were killed during the Second World War. But plenty of people who have looked into the matter understand that things didn't happen quite the way the Jews and their collaborators say they happened. But if such a knowledgeable person begins talking about what he knows, then he is discredited by all of the media under Jewish control as a Holocaust denier. The Lemmings believe the accusation without question, but perceptive people can see that it is a fraudulent accusation. They can see that there is a big difference between questioning the details of the Holocaust and denying that any Jews at all were killed or persecuted. And that's exactly why I talk so often about the Holocaust in my broadcasts. It's an easy and convincing illustration of the basic crookedness of the Jewish media bosses. Once a perceptive person sees the way in which the Jewish media fraudulently use the term Holocaust denier, he is much better able to understand and believe my assertion that the suppression of the news about what happened in Wichita 2 weeks ago was no fluke. It was deliberate and malevolent. The news was suppressed because the Jews want to keep the white public morally disarmed so that they can more easily destroy us. 5 years ago, I had a hard time getting people, even intelligent and perceptive people, to understand that. Today, there are hundreds of thousands of people in America who understand that, and the number is growing every week. And an important reason why this understanding is growing is that my ability to communicate with the public has grown. So if you ask me, how do we get from here to there? Tell us what we can actually do about our problems. Then my answer is, we can continue building our ability to communicate effectively with people of goodwill who are able to think for themselves. And then one day, we will be able to communicate with the Lemmings too. And when we are able to do that, we will be able to do everything else that must be done. That's what I'm doing. and it's for what you can do.
Dr. William Luther Pierce, the year 2000.
You can help me. I do need your support. Thanks for being with me again today.